today. Unfortunately, Representative Willis has an obligation in her district, so she is unable to join us today. But I think I'd like to get the meeting started. And the first order of business is to approve the minutes. Does everyone have a copy of the minutes from the October 29th? Meeting. Okay, can I have is there any discussion on the minutes? Jeannie, were they on everyone's? Okay. Yeah, we did. Oh, maybe we didn't approve. Yeah, we didn't. Last meeting, we didn't approve the October minutes. Yeah. Okay. These are from the prior meeting we're going with. So, is there any discussion on these minutes? If not, can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Okay, Judy, thank you. Is there a second? The motion. Greg DeSantis, thank you for seconding. Discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Motion is approved. Next, go into introductions. And so let's go, Carrie, I'll start and then go around the room that way. Just a brief introduction, please.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Kelly with the Office of Policy and Management.
Good morning. I'm Julie Savino, Sacred Heart University.
I'm Jen Widnitz with the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Michelle Cochran with Albertus Magnus College.
Heather Hamilton, Quinnipiac University and CAPFA.
Central Connecticut State University.
Mark French, Office of Higher Education.
J.D. Resnick, Planning Commission.
Jeanette Weldon, Connecticut Higher Education Supplemental Loan Authority.
Steve McDowell, Board of Regents.
Greg DeSantis, Housatonic Community College and the Faculty Advisory Committee.
Mona Lucas, University of Connecticut.
I'm Greg Headed, State Representative from the 54th District.
And I'm James Maroney. So, and one thing, thank you, I forgot to say, but please press your red buttons when you speak, but I didn't have to tell you, everyone did it as we went around. So is this being recorded for? It's being recorded. Okay, great. So the next thing, Carrie, if you'd just update us, please, on the Governor's Scholarship from the special session.
Sure, I'm happy to. As you know, last week, the General Assembly convened for the purposes of deficit mitigation, and the result was Public Act 15-1 of the December special session. The action eliminated a projected FY16 deficit of $350 million through a variety of expenditure reductions and modifications and revenue adjustments. Many of these impacts have FY17 implications as well. I'm happy to report that the Governor's Scholarship was not directly affected through any of this action. However, Section 3 of the bill does require the Office of Policy and Management to effectuate $93 million in lapse savings. We're required to impact individual line items by no more than 1%, and municipal aid is specifically excluded. Our office is still working on a strategy to implement this reduction, and we're very mindful of the implications that any reduction could have for Governor's Scholarship.
Great. Thank you very much. Next, what we thought would be helpful is to get different presentations from the different constituent units, meaning from the private schools, the community colleges, the state schools, on how they craft financial aid packages. So just to give everyone a better understanding of exactly where the Governor's Scholarship fits within their packaging of students and how we can utilize, again, our charges to align state financial aid policy with the goals of the Planning Commission. So hopefully this will give us information on how this is used to get students in and to help them graduate school, and then how we can effectively work with the Governor's Scholarship to accomplish those state goals. We are going to do a slight change in the order. If that's okay, Greg, would you be willing to present first?
Sure.
Okay. So first up is Greg DeSantis on behalf of the community colleges.
Thank you. Steve McDowell and I worked jointly on this presentation, and so I'm going to hand it off to Steve for the first part, and I'll take the second half.
Thank you. What we really wanted to do is kind of give a basic overview of our packaging policy. And on the first page, what I've put here is essentially verbatim from which stems from the old Board of Trustees manual. So our objective is to establish a uniform policy of awarding aid by meeting the direct educational costs of students who demonstrate need. And we define direct costs as a student's tuition and fees and an allowance for books for the year. So, I mean, obviously we're community colleges. We don't have housing or anything like that. To the next slide, our awarding procedure. Again, this is all verbatim from our policy manual. When a student's need equals or exceeds direct costs, the college will award grants equal to the direct costs. So essentially what our goal is to fully fund the student with grant dollars. I mean, we don't auto package loans for students. We're not in the business of setting students up with debt if we don't need to. Next bullet point, at the discretion of the financial aid office, colleges may award grants beyond their direct costs for students with remaining need. There are, you know, high cost programs such as nursing who do require students to quote unquote, you know, not work or work a limited amount, in which case they'd need student loans to supplement their living expenses. Students must meet all the satisfactory academic progress standards that we have published. And also, each college's financial aid office has the authority to make exceptions to this policy for individual students based on legitimate needs of students or to more effectively use the funds that they have. And if anybody has any questions along the way, please feel free to stop me. So the director of financial aid at each community college is responsible for developing and implementing essentially the different packaging groups. And what we do is we utilize an equity packaging model, which correlates to meeting the student's direct costs. So typically we have 3 to 4 different bands of packaging groups, and we really focus it around the Pell Grant. Is a student have no Pell, a little bit of Pell, a quote-unquote medium amount of Pell, or a lot of Pell Grant? And we try to really mix and match based on what the student's Pell Award is to meet that direct cost number. We can supplement that with set-aside money, with work-study loans on an as-needed basis. And also, I didn't put it, but the Governor's Scholarship Program also does factor into this, but a little later on, and we'll go into that afterwards. As far as delivery for a timeline, I really just wanted to give everybody an idea of from when a student registers to when we disperse financial aid. You know, we take a look at fall 2015. Registration for schools opened up on April 2nd. First day of the term was August 31st. We had ad drop through 9/13, and then we had our census on 9/21. And what our census does is really sets in stone a student's enrollment and gives us the basis to pay them. So all up until that point, when the student has the ability to add and drop a course, their enrollment and their aid really fluctuates up and down. And this happens multiple times a day. It could be for the same student multiple times a day, but it's really on and off. And Greg, you can speak to that more than I can at this point. But it's really an up-and-down kind of thing. And then a week after that, we disperse financial aid. And for the spring semester, it's really the same theory. You have registration, first day of the term, ad drop date, the census, and then you'll notice for the spring, 5 days after our census is when that Governor's Scholarship obligation date is. So in all actuality, for students who bounce their enrollment up and down through the 10th, our colleges have approximately 5 days to get their awards straightened out before the funds become unobligated and we can't award the students anymore. 2 days later, followed by disbursement. And
I just wanted to give an idea of summer because we did talk about awarding in summer as an idea a meeting or two ago. And this really differs for all colleges based on how many summer sessions they choose to offer. Okay, so typically registration would begin April 1st. A term would begin around June 1st. Our Governor's Scholarship Unit data reports are due on June 15th, even though we're still enrolling students for summer into the beginning of July. And then the term ends in August. So like I mentioned before on the next slide, we really try to maximize the Pell Grant as much as we can. In examples for the 2014-15 year, all of our community colleges did a little more than $81 million in the Pell Grant. And almost 69% of our total financial aid paid is from Pell, and which equated to more than 27,600 Pell Grant recipients. And you'll see that almost 78% of all of our financial aid recipients are Pell Grant recipients. So we are talking a very low-income population. And just below that, I wanted to give everybody an idea of the dollar amounts that we do broken down between grants and loans, work study, and scholarships. And you'll see that grants is more than 90% of what we give to students. On the next slide, I'll break down our direct costs. I mean, it's really very basic based on our packaging policy. It's tuition and fees, and then an allowance for books and supplies. Tuition and fee rates are approved by the Board of Regents, so those are set in stone. The colleges have the ability to determine what book and supply amount they choose to use in their cost of attendance figure. And I think the group of college directors has come to a consensus that $600 per term for fall and spring to give a full amount of $1,200 is enough, which is a sad reality that it's $1,200. But you have our direct cost for 14-15 was $5,066, and then the current 15-16 year is $5,272. So that's what we try to target for each student, is that dollar amount. And I think for the examples of different student packages, I'll ship it off to Greg.
Thanks, Steve. For the examples section, we have four different examples. We have three first from last year, so 2014-15. So you can kind of get a sense of what our packaging is like when it's all settled, everything's complete, it's done, it's never going to change again. And then the last example is 2015-16, so it's ongoing. So you can see what packaging is like right now, right this second, for the individual student used in example D. So to start with student A, you have a cost of attendance. This is an independent student. So in other words, most likely the student is either married or is age 24 or older. The EFC from the FAFSA, so the estimated contribution is zero, which means that the student has full need, the full $16,666 total cost of attendance for everything is need for that student. The student isn't expected to be able to contribute anything. So the student is receiving the maximum Pell Grant amount of $5,730. We supplement that because it's a zero EFC student, which we can do for some of those students with about $200 of supplemental grant, which means that the student has, you know, enough to meet those direct costs that we saw on the previous page, which are roughly somewhere around $5,200, $5,300, with a little bit left over for maybe transportation or, you know, other educational costs that might exist. The student has a lot of remaining unmet need, over 10,000 remaining, that the student could cover if the student chose with loans, or the student might just decide to work to cover the rest of their general expenses. You know, obviously students are not living on campus, so they have to find some way to support themselves, especially in this case when the student is independent and more likely not living with parents or other relatives. Student B has a little bit of a higher estimated contribution of $3,219 from the FAFSA and has a lower cost of attendance because this is a dependent student. So we've got a cost of attendance of about $10,000 here. This student has an unmet need of about $7,600. So the student is not receiving the maximum Pell Grant. Based on the EFC, the student received for the year 2014-15, $2,480 in Pell Grant. That's not enough to meet the student's direct costs of tuition, fees, and books. So we supplement that. We've got the Governor's Scholarship of $2,386, so that's going to be based on what that student was, how many credits the student had enrolled for in each semester, and the set-aside grant of $334. Eagle-eyed readers might notice that we have a typo at the bottom of 5,666. I apologize for my math. That should be 2,447 at the bottom, but the general idea remains the same, that there is still a small amount of remaining unmet need for this individual student, which the student, again, could supplement with a subsidized loan or choose not to take a loan at all. And most students end up not choosing to take the loan, if at all possible, at the community colleges. Student C, again, we have an independent student, so you'll see that $16,000 cost of attendance, much higher estimated family contribution. So maybe this person's working, spouse is working, you know, whatever the situation is, but the Department of Education estimates that the student can contribute, or the household can contribute, $12,435. So there is a limited amount of unmet need, $4,231, which means that, first, the student is not receiving any Pell Grant for the year because the EFC is outside of the range for the Pell Grant, but also the student cannot receive enough grant funding to cover the direct costs because of the overall need. So we give the student as much as we can, $4,231 in set-aside grant. That's very typical for us. You know, in the first three examples, I think the things to keep in mind are that we are going to award students, until we run out of money, as much as we can to keep them persisting from semester to semester. We want to make sure that we can cover tuition fees and books so they can actually attend class, not have a bill for at least those direct costs, and register again the next semester. So even for this student, student probably got about roughly $2,000 a semester for fall and spring, so enough to cover a lot of those costs, but at least we gave the student as much as we could up to the limit of their need. The last example, which is a lot more complicated, is an ongoing example from 2015-16. This is student D. The cost of attendance here is, this is a dependent student. You've got about an $11,000 cost of attendance, slightly higher this year, as costs are slightly higher from the previous year. The student has an EFC pretty similar to student B. So you're going to see a mix of funding for this student, just like you saw for student B. $7,160 unmet need means that the student gets a $1,925 Pell Grant based on the EFC. So again, the student has a lot of need at that point, is only automatically packaged about $2,000 in the Pell Grant. So we meet that difference with the set-aside grant. So $3,025. So again, we're aiming for that, you know, $5,300, $5,400 range to cover the direct costs. And the question mark comes in with the Governor's Scholarship. So we waited until the census date that Steve mentioned to make sure that we knew for certain what the student was going to be enrolled in for the fall semester. The student ended up being enrolled three-quarter time. Now, it could have happened that the student was enrolled three-quarter time in April. It could have happened that the day before classes were frozen, the census date, the student added a class, dropped a class, whatever it was, they ended up at three-quarter time as their frozen data. Based on that, we knew we could give the student $450 in Governor's Scholarship based on the student's EFC and three-quarter time. And the spring reward, we don't know what that will be yet. The student could end up getting a lot more in Governor's Scholarship, and maybe we'd end up reducing the set-aside grant for that semester. It could be the student doesn't get anything in the Governor's Scholarship. Maybe they only take one class in the spring semester. It could really be anything at this point. And one of the things that I guess I'll at least raise, and hopefully it's not too confusing, is one of the challenges there is, yes, it's nice in February to, you know, even though it's only a five-day window, to be able to say, now we can award this student. Let's say they got the 450 GSP again. They were rolled three-quarter time. And let's say we reduce the set-aside grant by the same amount, because we've got the set-aside grant set up right now, so we know it'll cover their costs. Again, our main thing is making sure that they have enough money to persist from semester to semester. So right now, the student sees a grant award for the spring on their end that is enough for their tuition fees and books. They can feel safe, comfortable. They know they can continue enrolling. If we reduce the set-aside grant at that point by $450, we have $450 more dollars to give to another student. The problem with this in practice is that we are awarding typically on a first-come, first-served basis. So if we run out of governor's scholarship in the first week of January for students, if we run out of set-aside money in the first week of January for students, and we have to stop awarding students set-aside money, those students will not enroll. So I'm getting the $450 back in that case at a time when enrollment is already frozen for the spring, and I can't give it to anyone. There are probably some students with partial, maybe we did it partially for a little while. We give students smaller amounts, and we can boost those students up a bit. But the way that the Governor's Scholarship functions right now, because we have to do it manually, because there isn't any way for us to figure out how to do it automatically, given the current parameters, we're in this situation where I don't think it's necessarily the most effective use of the Governor's Scholarship in terms of persistence or enrollment or, you know, just student awareness that they're going to be funded for the semester. And it may lead to a situation, I know, I don't want to speak too specifically because it's kind of up in the air right now, but I think most likely we'll be at a point at Housatonic Community College where we will run out of funding in terms of the set-aside for the spring semester. And there may be students who would like to enroll, even though they're last-minute students, that we just simply can't fund, even though later we'll get the governor's scholarship back to cover some of that. And we do over-award the set-aside, knowing that we're going to get some back and knowing that there's some expectation of shift between them. But there will probably be people that will be left out of that equation as a result. So hopefully that was not too confusing. The last page has sort of examples of how the GSP might be determined for that student. So if the student ends up being if the student's 5 credits or fewer, the student won't have any governor scholarship. If it's 6 to 8 credits, the student will be awarded $325. So that will be less than we've given for the fall. So we might end up adjusting the spring set-aside accordingly. Same. If it's 9 to 11 credits, we're going to be awarding the same amount. If it's 12 or more credits, all of a sudden there's a lot more governor scholarship going to that student, and we are going to be reducing the set-aside accordingly. So that we're aiming for that roughly $2,700, $2,500, depending on our target for that student, depending on whether they were a low Pell or medium Pell student. I forget exactly where they were. So the new spring award might end up looking something like this. The Pell Grant, $962.50, GSP, $1573, set-aside reduced to $164, aiming for that $2,700. So you can see that spring award that you're looking at there is very different than the fall award because the governor's scholarship shifts so dramatically when enrollment changes. And as Steve pointed out before, we will be doing all of that manual awarding for every single governor scholarship student. And I think, you know, I can't speak for all the community colleges, but I think it's pretty similar everywhere that on February 10th, when the enrollment's frozen, we all know that we have 5 days and hopefully not too many of them are weekend days to award every single student manually the governor scholarship that they're entitled to for spring and adjust their awards accordingly and redistribute those funds as necessary to other students if it's still possible before the obligation date occurs on the 15th. So that is the wonderful world of financial aid at the community colleges. I hope you enjoyed the tour. We're ready for any questions.
Judy.
I'm just curious about the scale. How many students at Housatonic actually received the governor's scholarship money?
I probably should have printed that out, but I don't know offhand. Do you have a sense of that? I don't know, and it's a little bit tricky too because we also have We're also phasing out the CAP grant program. So that is still, there's a mix of those students who are receiving the legacy grant. But it's probably, it's in the hundreds. I'm going to wild guess 500. I believe that we did in the first year, but we've sort of gotten a handle on that now. There's been some clarity on the awarding, and we haven't returned anything, I don't think, in the last couple of years from any institution. Is that right, Steve?
Yes.
I realize I think more than half the room consists of financial aid directors or financial aid officers, and the rest of us are the shell-shocked ones if you look around. So if you're in the audience looking up, you'll know who is a little confused. One thing I think we should state is that the community colleges are fairly unique, at least relative to the other constituent units, rather relative to UConn, the state universities, and the privates, in that you have more fluidity between the part-time and the full-time, where that is, I think people, so that's a bigger issue, I would believe, for you at the community colleges than it is in the other constituent units. Having stated that, what happens to a Pell Grant, though, however, you know, I understand it's a significant drop-off, right, in the amount of the governor's scholarship, but the Pell Grant also must be proportionally affected.
Right, so the Pell Grant and the set-aside work very similarly in that they are prorated according to the student's enrollment. So for the Pell Grant, for example, and Governor's Scholarship, I'm sorry, I keep saying that, set-aside is slightly different. It's a slightly higher percentage, but they roughly work in tandem. Pell Grant, if you are a full-time student, let's say you were awarded $2,000 in Pell Grant for the semester. If you're a full-time student for this semester, you're going to receive $2,000. If you are a three-quarter time student, so 9 to 11 credits of enrollment, you're going to receive three-quarters of your Pell Grant, so you'll get $1,500. If you're a half-time student, you'll get $1,000 in Pell Grant because you're enrolled half-time. And if you're a quarter-time student, so 3 to 5 credits, you'll get $500 in Pell Grant. Almost every band of Pell Grant works the exact same way, in that it's just going to be prorated three-quarters, half, a quarter, depending on your enrollment. Governor set-aside grant does the same thing at the 80%, 60%, 40% level, so it's pretty similar. And we award them assuming that they're going to work in tandem. So if a student has $2,000 in set-aside for the semester and they, just to give one example, and they're a half-time student, they're actually going to get $1,200 in set-aside actually paid out to their account because the costs are lower. Governor's scholarship is different in that it can fluctuate from, I believe, $1,500, just to give one example, for a full-time student. And then if you are a three-quarter time student, it'll drop to $450 for that semester, so not working in tandem with the Pell Grant or the set-aside. And then if you are a half-time student, it drops to $325. And then if you are a quarter-time student, you're not eligible at all. So because of that, we can't just put the governor's scholarship in there at the beginning and assume that, yeah, if we give you $1,500 governor's scholarship and, you know, $1,000 of set-aside, let's say, as an example, that it's going to prorate so that it's still going to cover your costs. Because if we give a student, in that example, $2,500 of just set-aside and they end up enrolling half-time, that's going to be a little over $1,200 that they're going to end up getting, $1,300 or so. For the semester, which will cover their costs. If they have a split of $1,500 governor scholarship full-time and $1,000 set-aside, and they enroll half-time, they're only going to end up getting, I think, about $900-something, just off the top of my head, which won't be enough to cover those costs. So we can't make that assumption. What we'll have to do is wait and manually award the governor's scholarship based on the enrollment, and then increase the set-aside to cover the costs, or, you know, do something else with the award so that we know for sure that the student can, again, achieve our main goal of persisting from semester to semester and not having an outstanding bill that they have to worry about and everything that goes along with that.
Greg, I have a couple of questions.
I'm a bit interested to know, when I look at example C, student example C, well, when I look at all examples, A, B, and C, and I know your philosophy is to meet the full direct costs, but it looks strange that as a student's EFC goes up or their income level is higher, you meet a higher percentage of need. And I wonder why a student who has a $12,000 EFC would be given a $4,200 grant. Again, I know you're trying to meet, but wouldn't it make more sense to take that $4,000 in grant, not try and cover their cost, because their EFC more than covers it, and put that grant money back down to students who aren't receiving anything? Because there is a category of students because there's not enough money.
Right. Yes, that is certainly one way to package students. But our concern then is that if a student's household looks like it can contribute $12,000 as an EFC, I think we all know that that's the reality of that is probably not too great. You know, that household can't actually pay out $12,000 or maybe anywhere close to it. And even if that is the case, our feeling is that, again, we want the students to persist from semester to semester. So if they are found to have need by the federal methodology from the FAFSA and our cost of attendance, we end up awarding those students because we know that they do have some need and we want to meet as much of that cost as we possibly can. In good years, we don't run out. In many years, we do run out. So the perspective then from our end is we know that this student's coming already. So student C, for example, might have applied for aid in April and wants to come to Housatonic all year as a full-time student. We don't know that a student is going to come necessarily at mid-January and want to enroll at the institution. Since that student's not there yet, it is sort of a first-come, first-serve model. And you might be able to speak a little bit more about whether or not you think other institutions sort of follow the same thing, in that we're awarding the students that we know are coming. And we're trying to assist those students first, even if their need is only partial, even if the Department of Education indicates that their estimated family contribution might be higher than some other students. We realize that the reality for these students is they've applied for aid, they have need, and we'd like to meet it if possible.
Okay. So, but there is a group of needier students who are left without as a result.
Potentially towards the end of the year if they've applied very late, yes.
One other question, if I may. I understand the problem of your students last-minute changing credit loads. But is there any type of academic advising done up front with those students to try and prevent or limit? Because what you're describing sounds like it's pretty chaotic. And students are, I want to be full-time, I want to be three-quarter time, now I can only go one class, now I want to go back to three-quarter time. What's done to help stabilize those students?
I think a lot more of it than we maybe suspect is actually an increase in enrollment. So, you know, we'd have the same problem no matter what the direction is. In that if we're jumping up from half-time to full-time for a student all of a sudden, their governor scholarship award goes from 325 to 1,500. So you have the same balance issue no matter what the end is. So, I mean, advising happens throughout. We have a lot of great direct advisors and counselors and faculty as well who advise. And students tend to be, I think, relatively stable in terms of their enrollment from semester to semester. But you know, again, even these small shifts make a big difference in terms of going from I'm taking two classes this semester and then this semester, I can take three classes. Great. Maybe I'm working a little less. Maybe my spouse affords me a little more time to take an extra class or something like that. You know, we want to encourage those shifts, especially if they're in the upward direction, and I think we do. And then I think sort of the other thing to think about is you've also got students becoming eligible because they're new that semester. You know, we also have that the population where, you know, they're not the traditional entering the fall student. Maybe they're coming for the first time in the spring semester, and we don't know exactly what that student's going to enroll for because, you know, there isn't that history there. So all of those shifts combined, and they're all small shifts, but they combine into, like you said, it's. I'm not going to deny that it's not chaotic, and it's, I think it would always be, and I think probably every community college in the country experiences that same chaos, but it's a lovely chaos to have, having those students, you know, make decisions about their educational future and hopefully enroll for more credits when they're able to, or back off when they know that they're not going to maybe be able to successfully complete courses in any given semester because of other responsibilities.
If I may, I do have one final, and that's it. On student D, the cost of attendance, the EFC, the Pell Grant, and the set-aside, are those full-year figures?
Yes. So we're awarding the student who we're anticipating is enrolling in the spring semester, yes, fall and spring.
So I guess I'm not following why you wouldn't just plug in 450 also for GSP, knowing that it could change, any student could change. But I'm not sure why you're saying you don't know what to give them. That would solve some of the obligation problem, because if the student, they'd have at least 450 obligated by February 15th. But that's just an observation on what these numbers are. So, thanks.
Sure.
I'd like to touch base a little bit about your question about student fluctuation with their enrollment. As a college that deals heavily with adult student learners, we've built a program to allow for flexibility in their life, so that they can come back and get a degree. But job responsibilities change, family responsibility change. We have students who have definitely different roles in their lifestyle. So when a death in the family happens, it becomes that student's responsibility versus an 18-year-old to 21-year-old's responsibility to plan for something like that. And it makes a huge difference in their ability to still remain successful in college. So we built a program which is very similar to a community college coming in with all ages, where we allow for that flexibility so that they can continue attending college regardless of whether or not it has to be full-time or part-time. And that meets the goals for the state of Connecticut to try to get all of our population educated, but at the same time, we are running into this issue where the constant change, which we've built to help them be successful, is becoming a huge burden on the financial aid office to continuously monitor. Now, this is not exempt from Governor's Scholarship. There's still also, for us, a lot of additional Pell changes and reallocations and things like that have to happen. But with the Pell chart, it's prorated based upon the number of credits that they're in, where it's very different and can cause enormous balances of what we're finding in our school when we have to retroactively go back and take money away.
Thank you. Carrie, I believe you had a question.
Yes. I'm struggling to understand how student A and student C are treated when they have identical costs of attendance. Are these real-life examples? Is this how you would pick the priority order of the student to receive governor scholarships and tuition set-aside?
So for student A... Maybe this will answer the question. If not, let me know. For student A, the student is just automatically eligible for that Pell Grant amount.
Right.
So we're more or less obligated to give the student exactly that amount of Pell Grant.
Yeah, that part makes sense to me. Okay. I think it's the fact that there's still a $10,000 remaining unmet need for that student.
And why that's left there when, for example, student C has no remaining unmet need and we've given them a grant?
Exactly.
Again, that's sort of the same question in a different way, in that we are trying to meet the need of a student up to the direct costs. So we're not looking at the cost. A school with a much higher cost than a community college, and I've worked at schools like that, might be looking more at the unmet need as one of the main things that they're looking at when they're determining how much to give an individual student. You know, they're looking more at what can this family afford to pay, what can the household afford to pay, and how much do we want to give that student compared to this other student. At the community colleges, we treat it a little differently. We want to meet those direct costs for every single student that we can for as long as we can. which again, in some years we meet everybody, and in some years we're not able to, depending on enrollment and how much there is in the set-aside in general. Sometimes governor scholarship shifts or things like that, although it depends from year to year. And additionally, you have to keep in mind that the number of students who are getting Pell Grant shifts from year to year. So one year we might have more students who are receiving more Pell Grant. The next year, maybe less. So our target is, how can we make sure that students have enough money so that they are not dropped from their classes because they can't pay for the tuition, the fees, and the books? You know, just looking at that very small direct cost of, you know, a couple thousand dollars, and can we cover that for the student if possible? So that's why student A, we know for sure that student A, based on the estimated family contribution, has enough just between the Pell Grant and, in this case, the supplemental grant to pay for the tuition and fees and books and actually have a pretty decent amount left over for, you know, relative to everything else. We're talking about a couple hundred dollars, but to pay for some other costs that they might have. If we gave that student A some of the money that was going to student C, because we know that student A has more need, it might help them with their day-to-day costs in persistence, but it won't help them pay their tuition, fees, and books bill, which we know that they have for sure. So I think most of the community colleges end up deciding to help student C as well with their need so that they can pay for the tuition, fees, and books. It's, I don't know if that approach makes sense.
I guess maybe I'm of this, in this example, the cost of attendance is $16,666. How much of that is direct cost?
It's the same for all of the students. It's
so
on the previous, $5,272 on the previous page before student A.
Okay.
So we're trying to meet that $5,272 for everyone. And the reason student C, we can't meet all of it, is because they don't have enough need to do so.
So the tuition set aside and the awarding of those dollars is prescribed by board policy,
mm-hmm.
and the priority order in which it's applied is based on the student, the individual student. I guess you first apply Title IV funds, right, Pell Grant, and then you would apply tuition set aside or governor scholarship?
It'd be set aside first, and it would be first come, first serve.
Assuming that they have need.
Wouldn't it make more sense to do governor scholarship first and then do tuition set aside?
Yes, if we knew what they were going to be enrolled for.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other? Greg, did you have a question? Okay. After Greg, okay, Jen.
Yeah, I was
just to follow up on one other question I had, which is. On the institutional set-aside, how does an institution know in the aggregate how much they're going to award in a given year? How is that budget set?
Within the institution, we work to estimate that. So we're looking at enrollment projections. We're looking at what did we use last year? How many students do we have to give it to? This is why, you know, we're setting a target amount and hoping that it remains relatively consistent. I don't know if you could speak to that more, but it is careful estimation, I think, is the best answer to that.
And it's 15% of, it's the prior year?
Yeah.
15% of the prior tuition.
Yeah.
15% of the prior year's tuition.
Correct.
And is that goal met at every institution, or is that a system-wide goal that is met?
That's the minimum, correct?
Right.
Are there years where the set aside isn't fully utilized? For say, if there's declining enrollment.
I haven't experienced that, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And do institutions typically exceed the 15% amount?
Yeah.
Right. And so how is that discretion exercised then? Like, how do you... is that decision made by the president of the college on an institution by institution basis?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Would it be possible just to look at some history on that? I'd look to the system office to see if they could produce for us maybe 1 or 2 years of experience data around that. That's interesting, I think, and I'm just curious to know how that plays out. Thank you.
Jen?
Well, just to follow up on Carrie's question, and I think you were maybe getting to it. Carrie asked, why don't you award GSP first? But we don't know, they can't, because they don't know what they're going to have a lot of, right? I mean.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to get across in general, is that we would like to do that first. I think, the years blur together in financial aid, but I believe with the CAP grant, we were doing that first. I think we would typically award those first and exhaust that fund, since we knew it was a set amount, more or less, and then move on to the set aside. That's I think that's pretty typical at most colleges. You'd spend the quote unquote outside money first, and then the institutional money next, because again, we can shift slightly. We might maybe want to spend slightly more than the 15% if that works for the president. Those adjustments are things that we can decide, whereas the other one is an allocated amount that we can't adjust. So we cannot do that, in our estimation, with the governor's scholarship currently, because we don't know what each individual student is going to be enrolled for on that census date.
I think you mentioned this to me, so I just... Are some of the community colleges having to send money back with unmet need because of the restrictions in the current program?
There have been colleges that have sent money back, yes. Governor's scholarship, yes.
Does anyone else have questions for Greg? I do have a few, but I'd like to let everyone else. Okay. All right, Greg. So I have a few questions for you, and I think you got at one. The decision to meet build costs, right, or attempt to meet the total build cost for each student, is that a Housatonic decision versus a Board of Regents?
I would assume that that's a Housatonic decision, but I think that I don't think any college deviates from that.
No, meeting the direct cost was originally a Board of Trustees policy.
Okay.
And carried forth to where we are now.
Okay. No, thank you. And another question, and I'm going to ask it for all of the financial aid directors so you guys can get ready for it, is one of the things we mentioned is that the goal would be, it would simplify the process if this could be a programmable, right, in the way that you package students. Now, it seems to me in listening to your explanation that all of the different pots of money have their own intricacies, right? So they're all not necessarily straightforward. What makes it that they're programmable and then the governor's scholarship is not able to be programmed? And for those of us who aren't in financial aid, myself included, I mean, I know enough words, I don't know what they mean, but I'm assuming Banner is the system, that one of the common systems that people use for packaging their financial aid. So I guess my question is, what would need to be done to make it programmable, and why isn't it programmable, given that the other programs also have a variety of restrictions?
So at least from our perspective, in reverse answer order, the reason that it's not programmable is because I think you really have to think about the idea of it not working well in tandem with the other grants that exist. So forget that Pell exists for a minute, and forget that set-aside exists for a minute. Let's say that only Governor's Scholarship existed. You could make it whatever you want. You could say a full-time student's going to get $1,500, a part-time student's going to get 100, you know, whatever you want, because there's going to be no other shift in aid for that student. There isn't anything else. So students would know, we would publish, at, you know, as we generally do, that, you know, your governor scholarship is going to drop dramatically if you drop below full-time, because that's the only funding source available, and those are the rules, and that's how this applies, right? The problem comes up when you add in other grants that do work in tandem, which in this case are the Pell Grant and the set-aside grant. The supplemental grant is a really small amount and does have really specific rules, but it's sort of, it really just goes to students at the community colleges, I think for the most part, with a zero EFC. So it's a really kind of a special case. So just talking about those three, the Pell Grant and the set-aside work in tandem because they prorate to roughly the same amounts. So just to take one example, if you're a three-quarter time student and you have Pell Grant and you have set-aside, you're going to get 75% of your Pell Grant and 80% of your set-aside money. So those will pretty much work exactly the same, more or less. The Governor's Scholarship, on the other hand, is going to drop by more than two-thirds, right? From 1,500 to 450. So that does not work in tandem. So if I give a student, let's say, set-aside and Governor's Scholarship, and they're full-time, and they drop to three-quarter time, one of their grants is going to drop dramatically, and the other won't. As a result, that student is going to be left with direct costs that are unmet. We don't want to leave direct costs unmet. So as a result, we'll have to change their total award so that the direct costs are definitely met. That's the reason that it's not programmable. Now, when I say not programmable, I'm sure that there exists somewhere, or could exist somewhere if it doesn't actually exist, some student information system like Banner that could program an incredibly complex formula. You know, Rich, I'm not sure if you're usually pretty good at that, if you could figure something out like that, but even that is, you know, so complex that it, you know, it's probably beyond the scope of what our programming abilities are, and maybe even beyond the abilities of the system, student information system in general. Because you'd have all the shifting money in both directions all over the place anytime a student adds or drops, and it's important to understand that, as was mentioned earlier, those adds and drops could happen multiple times in the same day. So a student could say, you know what, I'm going to take 9 credits, I'm going to go up from 6 to 9, and then later in the day says, oh, this class is interesting too, let me go up to 12 credits, and then realizes, you know what, I can't handle that, let me go back down to 9 credits. So we've had 3 different levels of enrollment in one day. There's, you know, your system would have to be able to constantly shift, and the student would be receiving award notifications that would wildly shift from, you know, even within the same day, saying, this is your new award package. No, this is your new award package. So practically, it's unlikely that we'd find a way to automate something like the Governor's Scholarship because it doesn't work well in tandem with the Pell Grant and the set-aside. Does that answer that part of it, at least?
Yeah, so basically it is programmable, it's just not easily programmable.
Right.
It's one of those things where, given the time and money, anything is possible, but
sure.
Since we don't have... Okay.
Sure. What was the other part? Is you had a second part, or first part to your question that I skipped over. Hopefully one of us recalls.
Yeah.
Play the tape back.
Yeah, we'll have to go to that next meeting. The only other question that I have for you now is the what happens with tuition set-aside money that, and I know you've, so this is more for Steve than it is for you, if tuition set-aside money is not utilized in a year, is that carried forward to the next year, or?
No. Eric, I'm going to defer to you on that one.
The tuition set-aside is just one element in a very complicated college budget, so if it's not fully utilized, the expenses are consumed someplace else.
Okay.
Thank you. Does anyone else have questions for either Greg or Steve? Okay. If not, thank you very much, Greg and Steve. We'll move on to the next presentation. So, Jen, would you mind introducing?
So I'm not going to present. I just asked my colleagues that are here. We have a number of people that are here that represent different private colleges, and everyone serves a slightly different student body. So I thought that since Greg sort of laid the foundation of how packaging works broadly, that they could just distinguish a little bit about how it works at their institutions. I'll start with Michelle because she's probably the most similar to the community colleges. And then Heather Hamilton is here from Quinnipiac. Julie Savino is here from Sacred Heart. And Kelly O'Brien is here from Trinity College. And we can just go in that order, whatever makes sense, and feel free to chime in as needed. So,
sure. So from, like Jen said, Albertus is not your typical independent private college. We use federal methodology, which is very similar to what state and community colleges use as well, which means we figure out our need based solely on the FAFSA. So whatever they calculate as the expected family contribution, that's what we utilize. So we use our cost of attendance, which is the general tuition fees, resources, books, and then if the student's living on campus, housing, as well as personal expense. And if they're living off campus, there's still a housing component. It's just not, because in the end, it costs for the student to live somewhere. And then our goal is not to stop at necessarily direct costs, but we try to do as best as we can with the total cost of attendance. Albertus averages around 75% of need. That being said, we have a very high need population, with 58% of our incoming freshmen being Pell eligible students. So we cater to a lot of the same students that a community college or a state school would cater to as well. Our packaging formula is very similar to what the community colleges do as well. We start with federal aid, Title IV grant aid. We move on to our institutional, what you would, I'm assuming, is called the set-aside. And then we go from there as to the state aid. So it's really similar in its setup. We have two very different types of student bodies, though. So our traditional undergraduate students, for the most part, no matter what, I mean, we had about 51% of our students meet their full tuition and fees only, so not their total cost of attendance. And we were certainly able to do that with the help of the Governor's Scholarship. But, you know, there's still 50% that have outstanding tuition and fees at our school, and that's just because of the general cost. That being said, we do offer for our population of 500 students around $8 million, and we try our best to utilize that and spread it out. I'd have to say we do almost the exact same thing when it comes to your student with a high need. We try to help them out with as much as we can, with the high EFC population. And then definitely our zero EFC population, we do the same, but they have a much higher need, so we have to utilize additional resources, not just grant funds, to fill their need. As for your question as to programming it, our day population, absolutely, very super easy to program into the system. 99.9% of our day, we have 5 part-time day students out of our 500. So that's it. So 1% of our population out of our 500 is not full-time. And they are not full-time because they may only need 6 credits to graduate. So they're not going to take on all that extra cost if they don't need to. And plus, I'm not going to pay for classes that don't go towards their degree. So we, they're specialized for that reason why they're not. Or they're special students who are only coming to our college to take a class. Maybe they're not actually a matriculated student at Albertus, type of thing. So what we have is... in that population, very easy. We use PowerPhase as our financial aid processing system. Automatically, if you're a Connecticut resident, we can set it up with the tiers based upon your expected family contribution and have it added in. It's our evening population, which is our transitional population. We have 700 of those that are undergraduates, and they are very, very flexible. Not only do we have the modular-based ones where it's two terms within one semester, and we're awarding semester-based aid towards that, to them. So that's a high processing change where we're constantly monitoring and watching because they don't begin all classes at the same point in time for one semester that we're trying to push semester-based aid to them. The other part of it is our non-term population, which per federal regulations, they are full-time because they're completing a certain number of credits, but their start and end times can be at any point of the year. So you can start any month, but you can also end any month. And those are very hard to squeeze into a July 1st to June 30th time frame of spending money. And also to have all of your funds exhausted by a specific deadline, because I'm going to have students that start after that time. And to remain consistent and try to offer aid equally and fairly to all of our students, that deadline to make sure all of your funds are expended by a specific point in time is very tough to meet at times. Did you have any specific questions? Like I said, Albertus is very similar to what you're going to find with the state and the community colleges, except for we have the ability to probably give a lot more aid for 500 students. But otherwise, overall, I think you give out more money anyway.
Carrie?
Michelle, did I hear you correctly that Albertus awards $8 million to 500 day students in institutional aid?
Yes.
That's a pretty high average.
95% of our students receive some form of institutional funding. Now, that's not all grant money. That is a combination of grant and merit aid. But with our student population, majority of them have need. So it's a matter of, in the end, it's a portion that goes against their need when it comes to paying attention to federal and state funding levels.
So you award $8 million in institutional aid, which the equivalent would be tuition set aside at the Publix, and that's only given to the day students, the 500. Is any of that awarded to the evening students who are more part-time in nature?
The only evening student aid that's given from the institutional is stuff that's been created through endowment. So we've had evening graduate students go and create a special fund for full-time evening students that they say maybe $1,000 for the whole year can go towards paying their tuition and fees. For the most part, our evening students receive federal aid. Sorry, my contact's been weird. Federal aid and state aid. The federal aid portion, if you're receiving your student loans and your Pell Grant, is enough to cover the cost of tuition and fees. And again, with a very high need population, the majority of our students do receive the federal Pell Grant.
So for the evening students who are more part-time in nature, what proportion of them would have their direct costs met through federal aid? And
if you're including loans, our juniors and our seniors absolutely do. It's our sophomores and our freshmen that tend to have an out-of-pocket expense. It is $1,551 per credit, or not per credit, sorry, per course that they're taking at this point in time. So it's definitely a different amount of money also that they're paying. A evening student for 24 credits is paying just under $13,000, where a traditional day student for the same 12 credits is paying just under $29,000. And it's because of the student experience. These ones have student activity fees, things like that, where the evening students are at a accelerated degree cost, things like that. So it's definitely a different cost of attendance also that they're looking at. The day students get to participate in athletics. They have other things, where the evening students don't have any of those abilities to utilize.
Also, the services are different from day population versus an evening population across all institutions. So the costs are always a little different.
So would it be safe to say that the institutional aid philosophy and who they award it to is more targeted to the full-time student rather than the part-time?
At Albertus, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Does anyone else have other questions? I just have one question. So you give $8 million an institution between institutional merit aid and need-based grants. What is the approximate, the aggregate amount of Governor Scholarship?
So Alberta's received just under $1 million in merit scholarship for the 15-16 academic year. Our traditional day population has the highest need. They pay a higher tuition fee, so they do receive a large portion of that. Give me one second. 55% of our day students received Governor Scholarship funding. That being said, we have 86% of them came from the state of Connecticut. And our average expected family contribution is $10,249. So we have a very high need population that does qualify for the state grant. We are able to give the majority of our day students the ability to utilize the state grant. It's our evening students that we run out of funding to help supplement them.
So it's $1 million in Governor Scholarship to $8 million in your own school
money.
Last
year we received just under, or right around $1.5 million.
Thank you.
Heather's here. Oh, sorry. Heather's here.
Were any of the Governor Scholarship awards made to part-time or evening students?
Absolutely. I don't have the exact figures off the top of my head, but I'd have to say for this academic year, 75% of our funding went to our traditional day students. And 25% went to our evening population, which fluctuates from term to term, depending upon what's right for them, what fits for them. So, again, I want to touch back to, do we have academic advising? And the answer is absolutely. But sometimes the advising is, it's better for you to go part-time for this term so you can still remain successful. Even though it may mean a cut in funding, it's better than losing your satisfactory academic progress and failing the class or dropping out and having to go into repayment on your student loans. It's making what's the best decision for that student at that point in time.
Thanks. So Julie Stupino from Sacred Heart is going to go next. And if there's any, if any of these numbers would be helpful, since we didn't do anything in writing, if you have follow-up questions, we can certainly put something together. Because I know there's a lot of numbers being thrown out.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present some of our merit-based program, our packaging philosophies. As opposed to the other presenters, I'm going to take a little bit different approach. The majority of our funding begins when a student is accepted for admission. So a merit-based aid is awarded to students based on their characteristics, and that's done at the acceptance stage. So those awards are made need-blind. It really isn't even looking at a financial aid form or anything else, and those awards are given to students, actually within our population, almost 97%. It's not just academic. It's academic, it's athletic, it's participation, it's leadership, it's community service. It comes in a variety of different shapes and forms. Need-based aid will be taken care of later at the process, but students are awarded first up front at the point of their acceptance. We have 97% of our students, full-time undergraduate students on financial assistance. It totals about 4,300 plus students in any one typical year, depending upon the students that we have. Decisions are made out of operating budgets very well in advance of the beginning of an award year, usually 6 to 9 months in advance of us accepting our students, and we're done kind of like on a tuition discount basis as to what the institution can absorb within an expense budget in any one given year. Those numbers are sought after very carefully. They're Board of Trustee approved. They're usually looked at your Moody's and Standard & Poor's and other places that value your institutions as to what's reasonable for your fiscal soundness. This past year in 14-15, we awarded almost $60 million to our students to all of our students, and that's all students, Connecticut and other states, so 60 million. So then once that student is accepted and the award process begins, of course, we have our financial aid deadlines that are actually earlier than a FAFSA. Many private institutions, because the majority of our money is our own that we're awarding to our students, we tend to use alternative methods of need analysis. And at a private school setting, a very popular form that's used primarily in the Northeast is the CSS profile, and I believe many of our other colleagues use a similar form. We then use what we call an institutional methodology, which varies oftentimes from the federal methodology. So, you know, when we get to the awarding of our own institutional need-based funds, we might be using a different methodology other than the federal. So when all of those forms have arrived from the students and we begin our award process, which is our packaging process, utilizing all of those, and we wait until all the students have submitted their applications by the preferred deadline. So for whether it's an early decision candidate, whether it's an early action or a regular decision student, we'll all move according to those particular deadlines. Typically, our awarding will begin in February, and we'll look at when our average award date is February 15th, when we require all of our forms to be in, making sure that all students are getting their applications in who want to be considered for financial assistance and making those evaluations. Once those awards and we begin from the accepted student stage, we'll understand first what merit-based aid has that student been given and awarded, from everything, again, from the athletics to the academics to the participation and others. So that's the first level of need that a student might have, is given that after the family's EFC is evaluated. We'll look at the total cost of education, subtract from that their EFC, and then the merit-based aid is awarded from that point. For those students who do not demonstrate any need beyond that, if their EFC were higher, then there's no additional aid given to that particular student. For example, if it was a student with an EFC of zero, because everybody seems to understand that that's our most needy population, it also could be a very strong academic student. And in that case, they might be receiving an academic grant from Sacred Heart, for example, of $16,000. In addition to that, they might have been accepted to an honors program, and they would get another $2,000. And then we'll look at their Pell Grant eligibility. If they're receiving their Pell Grant eligibility as a full-time student, they'll next be awarded their federal Pell Grant, which, again, is based on a matrix of determination, which is more or less their entitlement. So that's another $5,700 against their need, okay, that unmet need that still remains. And then if we look further, that student might then be eligible, because they're our most needy, our SVOG grants are programmed to be able to, until that fund is exhausted, meet the needs of the students at the highest level first, and we determine those awards. Now, some of those might be 2,000, as you go down, even though those students might be Pell eligible, it might be down to 1,500, 800, and then even some students who have Pell grants get zero because the funds are exhausted before all of our students' needs are met. The next thing would be that we would award the Connecticut grant, and in the prior years, we have always done that. We have then looked at the student's EFC. Did they still have remaining need? And we would make that award according to now the matrix or our eligibility until, again, those funds are exhausted for all those students who met the date and the funds no longer. I have to say, we have stopped awarding Connecticut Governor Scholarship Program. Last year we did not award because we were hesitant, because we had such a huge growth in our student enrollment, particularly our Connecticut residents, and our money ran out very quickly because it was based on a previous year's allocation. And of course, that allocation, it came in very funky, very late in the year. So we decided in the next year, because we were very unsure as to what was coming down the pike, that we would have any money available based on our prior experience. So this past year, we didn't. And thankfully, we didn't make or extend those offers to our students, because our allocation came in 19% less than it had the prior year. So we were only left with $700,000 to be able to award to all of our Connecticut students. Once our returning student obligation for those who had already met the criteria still continued to be academically eligible and were able to receive those funds, we had virtually nothing left for our freshman class. So from there, we would have then said, next layer of need is depending on the amount of need that is remaining, again, depending upon the amount of the threshold that we've set on an individual student, because at a certain point, an individual student cannot exceed a certain percentage discount. That's how Sacred Heart uses it. It's not like other institutions do, that we would award some additional need-based aid to that student should they have financial need. And again, after that, it's the loans, right? It's the loans, it's the Stafford loans, the subsidized and the unsubsidized. And what usually typically remains, even for a zero eligibility student, after you even account for some work study allocations that a student might be receiving, is some significant unmet financial need that the student then has to make a decision as to where they're going to actually receive those funding, those funds from. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
I'm going to correct you. Your allocation went down 35%.
Oh, my allocation went down
30%.
Okay. Does anyone have questions for Julie? Carrie?
I'm going to ask my standard question. Do you award Governor Scholarship to part-time students?
We're not awarding it to any new students right now.
So the continuing students are all full-time students?
They're primarily all full-time students. By the time those funds are in, we are barely able to touch the surface with those students who are eligible on that. Now, with the inability to be able to determine levels of award, in prior years, we might have said we could award up to 8,000, and we decided as an institution to reach the largest amount of students' population. We would then say we're going to cap our awards for students, certain students with different EFCs, at an amount much lesser than that, so we could spread it around and it would touch a much larger population. Now, with the matrix approach that we have no flexibility to that. So if they get $3,500, they get $3,500. We don't have the determination to say we could reach more students if we dropped that award to 2,000 or to 1,500. Then maybe going through all our Connecticut students and then perhaps even reaching some of our part-time students. Part-time students typically make very late decisions as to how they want to award. It's not that student who's planning and looking for access to higher education much earlier on. So right now we're dealing with students who want to be able to enter our institution next fall for the first time. We're making those awards right now. So, and they're the ones that are needing to make their decisions, deciding to where they want to go and how they want to approach their education and understand their affordability. You know, really 9 to 10 months to almost a year right now in advance.
Thank you. And being mindful of everyone's time, I forgot to wear a watch and I just checked it. I really, we're almost noon. I do like to try to keep these to an hour and a half at a maximum. However, I think what would be valuable for us to hear would be from the private schools before going on to Rich to hear about a different, the state schools, would be the percentage of students you have from out of state. And then for the two who haven't presented yet, for Heather from Quinnipiac and Kelly from Trinity, where the Governor's Scholarship fits in your order, I think, in the order of packaging.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity. Trinity meets 100% of demonstrated need. However, in order to fulfill that philosophy, we need to look at a student's need at the time of admission. And we are only able to, based on pulling all of the resources together from the state, the federal government, and our own endowment and income from the other students' tuition and fees, we are only able to have about 40% of our students on need-based aid. so just getting accepted and into the door for the neediest of students is very challenging. We only have about 14% of our students receiving Pell Grants. So that's the challenge for the very needy student even getting accepted. As Julie mentioned, Trinity requires two forms for the families to apply for financial aid. They file the FAFSA and the CSS profile application. The FAFSA, over the years, in my opinion, has not been a very valid calculation of a family's ability to fund their education. Trinity looks at the CSS profile not only for the custodial family, we look at a non-custodial profile. We look at the other resources, perhaps a parent works at an institution and has a tuition benefit. We look at all of the resources and we then meet 100% of the need after we calculate what we think is a fair family contribution. In the past, we had flexibility with the KICS program to not award it at all if we felt that the family, even though they were qualifying for a Pell Grant with the FAFSA, we would look at resources from perhaps a non-custodial parent and say, or we would look at the FAFSA calculation itself. Families can get a zero family contribution from the FAFSA and have significant resources. It just happens to be a negative AGI or resources that aren't taken into consideration in the FAFSA program, so that we just don't think it's valid. And the Pell Grant, right now, we give out to some families, they get a Pell Grant and nothing else from Trinity College itself. And that's what we used to do, trying to be good stewards of the Connecticut scholarship. Now with the changes, and we're locked into the FAFSA for the calculation for that, we do award the student based on the income grids, just like we do the Pell Grant that we're locked into. So I would recommend that we have some flexibility in the awarding of aid, not necessarily tied to the FAFSA number. We also have families, our cost of attendance is over $65,000, $66,000 this year, up to $68,000 next year probably. So families that have a $14,000 family contribution, which might be the average for us, we are awarding more than $40,000 of our own institutional grant. Plus, if we can have the subsidy of the federal or the Connecticut scholarship, it does help meet that need of the families. So my recommendation also would be the flexibility within the calculating, not using the FAFSA number necessarily. Also, our high cost of attendance with the Pell Grant only, there are some families that have a $12,000 or $13,000 family contribution just above the threshold for the FAFSA that they would get zero from the state. It just seems like a stepping cutoff that you get $3,000 or $2,000 and the next student gets zero. And so we just like to just spread it out a little bit so that everybody gets to share from these programs. If we could have that flexibility, that would be great too. Let me stop there and see if there's any questions.
Thank you very much. Heather, if we just briefly.
Mine is very brief because I'm not really referring to Quinnipiac per se, more so, yes, I can say Quinnipiac, as most privates do. The timelines are very similar. They're awarding much earlier than they know about any awards coming from the state. They're committing. May 1 is the deadline for most private schools to make decisions. So families are looking and hoping that what they see on that day is the award that they're getting, which may change if the schools do go ahead of time, and then are they able to absorb the extra resources. Mine is more because I represent CAPFA on this committee, is really, we did a survey, we'll be sharing it with you, but it's the timing, the flexibility, the lack of knowledge that the schools, I think, are facing the frustration with across the board. That is really, I think, the one thing that you want to know. And in regards to, could it be programmed? Sure, at some schools, I'm sure it could be programmed. But with all the unknowns, that come in because of the timing, because of things that are happening later, I think it becomes more of a hindrance. And if we had it in a sense that it was more of a Pell table, whether we want a Pell table or not, because I do agree with Kelly that the FAFSA does take away a lot of things that should not be. I've seen million-dollar families who get a Pell grant. So they're also then getting a state grant. But if we had some tierage, some flexibility, because we also know our students, and what I've heard from a lot of our members is there's no way to help the student that we know that little bit would get them over the hump versus another family that could afford it. And with a part-time, if there was a little more of a flexible grid that it wasn't so drastic, that might help too. So hopefully that helps.
Okay. Thank you. Rich, would you...
Gee, I feel like I'm a middle child here, but, you know, it's like... I'm the youngest. I'm not as wealthy as my colleagues to the left, and I'm not as, no offense, poor as Greg is to the right. So it's like, you know, I'm in a perfect location, I guess, in some respects. We do award based off, our goal really is access and affordability. I mean, that's our basic premise. We use the FAFSA only. We have a March 1st deadline for our incoming and new transfer students. Well, at least March 1st for incoming students, April 15th for our new transfer students, April 15th application for our continuing students. Once we get all that data, we start pushing out our money. Some basic facts is that our governor's scholarship represented $3.3 million last year, or for the current year. Our Pell Grant is going to be roughly $14 million. Our SEOG grant program will be $324,000. The university set aside with approximately about $6.7 million, and we'll probably spend about $44 million in federal student loans. So the majority of our money actually comes from the federal government. A lot of it's for loans. If you look at our tier grouping, we've actually mirrored the governor's scholarships. Our first tier of students really is the zero EFCs. We feel they're the neediest. Our goal is to meet their tuition fees and a reasonable amount for books with grant money, either from the governor's scholarship or from the university set-aside funds. We feel that's the basic premise for them to be able to afford the institution. Our next grouping is a similar thing. The percentage of 36% really represents their tuition fees and a reasonable amount for books to get them to the point where they don't have to borrow any money. Our true goal is try to keep the indebtedness down as low as possible. After that, we break it down to different groupings, and it's just mirroring, a lot of it mirrors the governor's scholarship. Try and make sure they maximize at least the $3,000, and if there's more eligibility, then we give them more grant money. We blow out pretty much a lot of money. This year alone, we had 7,000 freshman applications to review. We've had 11,000 continuing students. We awarded 1,000 freshmen. And so far we've awarded 6,000 continuing students. You know, so we award a lot of money up front because we're not sure who's going to enroll. It's all based on the premise that you will be full-time. But if you are part-time, no offense, Greg, we do automate with a very very difficult algorithm packaging group. And me and my little minions painstakingly have written this thing, and it is complicated. It is not easy, and when we do our packaging runs, and then we go back and do them again, and we review them all the time. So it can be done, but it's painful, and I would not want to go through the pain again. So please don't ask, but if you need help, let me know. So as I said, our main goal is trying to get affordability and access to a lot of our students. About 45% of our students receive Pell Grants. It may not be the best formula, but it's a formula we have to deal with the federal government and with the state agencies. So that's where we look to access our money to. And that is a quick nutshell there, so you can ask any questions.
Does anyone have... Okay. Thank you very much.
Are you?
I mean, I think that I just have a question for Kelly. I know we're moving quickly along, but I mean, or just to summarize that, at least at the privates, everyone packages really differently. But I think that it all, the Governor Scholarship aid is really important to them all, and for different reasons. Which is, I'm not going back to the old program. I'm just saying, but the other program, when it, the KICS program allowed for flexibility so that it could be utilized very differently at all the different private colleges. So for a school, and correct me if I'm wrong, at Trinity, if their need, they meet all needs, but they look at your need when you're applying, it hinders their ability to accept more needy Connecticut students because they know that their allocation keeps dwindling in Governor's Scholarship Program, whereas before they knew if they accepted more Connecticut, needy Connecticut students, they would get more aid to support that because the price tag is so high. But good talk.
Right. I looked at the data this morning and saw that at the high we had $781,000 from the state of Connecticut at one point. That would actually fully fund 24 students. Today, this year, we're getting just over 200,000. We can barely get five students funded. So it might seem small, but to us, as the dwindling $500,000, it's significant in the percentage on aid and the admission rate.
Thank you. Jen, just two questions for you, and then kind of just move into our next steps. Actually, it could be for any of the financial aid advisors. I know we say that the Governor's Scholarship is small. And it was years ago I remember reading a study in Chronicle Higher of Education on the amount of money that it takes for a student to make a decision on one school over the other. And it was, I believe it was around $1,500. But that, I mean, that's like, I'm going back over 10 in increased aid could help tip their decision. But does anyone know of that number or studies of that sort?
I don't know specifically studies or information of that, but I think what we've seen significantly, at least for those of us who have a lot of merit-based aid and are pretty competitive with the, you know, we have the Trinities of the world that do the need analysis and do strictly on need, and then there's the whole host of institutions that are really on the merit-based kind of competitive side. We've seen that, you know, anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000 can make or break a difference based on what the other institution may offer. The bigger issue for us is that our competitive institutions are not necessarily our Connecticut institutions, but they're the ones from out of state who are looking to get the students out of the state of Connecticut or looking to win more against, you know, taking some of our students who are applying across similar type of institutions outside of our own state borders, and that's where it is. But they'll come back and appeal to us. They'll show us the other financial aid offers that they get from those other institutions, and it really kind of pushes us up against, you know, against a wall. It's not necessarily what you see. We can't say, well, what you see is what you get and then be done with it. I mean, you know, so it's becoming more and more difficult for the majority of the institutions that kind of sit in that kind of awarding, packaging kind of cycles.
I just,
thank you.
I can't let that moment pass without just saying something about the financial aid shopping sheet that we use in the state. I think that actually sort of plays a role in the competitiveness and the understanding about how much a student's getting versus not. So I just have to throw it out there that because we are required to use a federal shopping sheet, it makes it hard for students to compare from one state to the next. I'll let Heather talk about it really quick.
No, you are exactly right. With the shopping sheet, we're providing information across the board. It's a very generic one. Just as a side note, it does not work for grad at all because everything is undergrad related on the form. But we have schools that are showing the shopping sheet who have no competition in the state of Connecticut and would love to have their students here, but they show the shopping sheet and nobody else in any other state has a shopping sheet, so they don't understand what they're getting and why. So comparison is great if you're comparing everybody apple to apple, and it doesn't really show in the same way that you would really think what students can totally understand and see what their actual package is, because there's no ability to change or edit or caveat anything. We actually had some schools here in the state that were actually using it as their only source of awarding that were losing students to competitors right here in the state because of the lack of clarification. So the shopping sheet is definitely hurting, I think, us in some ways because there's not a comparison to another state.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for everyone who made your presentations today. I think it's valuable for us to see how really each school is different in the way that they package the students. And the one thing that we're looking at and that we can control as a state is the governor's scholarship. And how do we leverage that with what you're doing to service? Ultimately, my opinion is that our customer here is the student. And so how do we use this money to maximize the benefit for the student and to achieve, and again, the goal of this commission is to align our state financial aid policy with the goals of the Planning Commission for Higher Education. So how do we maximize our ability to achieve those state goals? As for the next steps, we're coming up on, it's a short session. I'm seeing what happened with the budget and that they had come back for a special session. I believe that that will dominate, so that we need to look for recommendations that we can make and I would like to see at the next meeting to discuss a little further on how we should make those recommendations, meaning that are we only going to make recommendations for this coming year that come out of here unanimously so that they are easier to go through, or what do we define as a consensus recommendation to make to Representative Haddad and Representative Willis to make it easier for them to actually get those changes put through legislation. And speaking of that, so far, and again, this is going off of my impression, I've been trying to take some notes as I go through, and so I'm sure I missed some things, but just wanted to kind of recap the ideas that we had discussed that I believe have consensus, ones that we've discussed that I don't know if we have consensus yet, and then also other things that I had been thinking about that I would like to give you the opportunity to tell me when you're not being recorded how crazy I am. So I'll put it out there now that you can come to me afterwards and let me know. Don't bother discussing that. The other thing is for our future presentations, I believe since the session starts in February, that I would like to do, if possible, if your time permits, and again, thank you all for your time, but to do two meetings in January. If possible, Mona, I would like to have UConn present on how they package students at one of those meetings in January. And another tool that we do have in Connecticut that we really haven't discussed much is CHESLA. So, Jeanette, if you may be able to speak a little bit about what CHESLA can offer, and perhaps we can discuss in between what would be valuable to hear from you in one of those meetings. And then the second meeting in January would be to solidify at least the recommendations for this coming session. Some of these ideas, I believe, will take longer to flesh out. So another thing to discuss would be, do we continue as a working group in finding out what we can do to try to... I feel it's been productive discussions. I hope that you feel your time has been well spent and that these have been productive discussions. So how we can continue moving forward. But just to recap those ideas, and then I think that we had discussed potentially switching to prior year for making the allocation of the Governor's Scholarship Program, although we have heard, I mean, the benefits would be you would be notified of your percentages of the pie earlier on. However, hearing now how your percentage of students changed drastically from year to year, that may create a problem for some. Again, there's always these unforeseen problems. Publicizing the formula for the allocation of Governor's Scholarship money, and Mark had discussed that last time and how that was done and the points for full-time versus part-time students, but just putting that out there. Changing the date for returning the unobligated money to give you more time. I believe these were consensus issues. Other ideas we've discussed were, looking at the need merit system. increasing the amount of part-time awards, you know, whether we were to prorate or, you know, changing the way we allocate that, and then looking at increasing, or not increasing, including summer session in the packaging. Those were ideas that had been discussed. Ideas that, you know, I've been thinking about that I would like to throw out there. It seems to me the academic incentive grant comes after for many of the schools, the packaging, and looking at ways that we could utilize that pot of money, which only looked, based on, I think, the numbers you had put out, Mark, I think it was $600,000 to $720,000 in a given year for the academic incentive grant, and just looking at things that we could do with that, I would like to discuss. Again, incentivizing, obviously, the goal is completion, and that is rewarding people. And those are just some of the ideas. The other thing, you know, we had discussed at one meeting, and I had asked questions when Sarah was here from the Education Commission for the States, was looking at if there are any tax incentives, which, again, we don't have, may not have money for tax incentives, but looking at them, whether it's incentivizing companies to repay student loans, or the other is incentivizing if there are ways to get people to donate into the Governor's Scholarship program to try to increase, leverage our money that way, to increase the amount of money that we do have to give out. And another thing was looking at the way information is submitted. I think we had discussed on the P20 win and the data sheet, you know, what are the similarities between what's submitted to OHE and to P20 win to try to streamline. And then, you know, another idea, you know, Sarah Pingle from the Education Commission from the States had talked about, I guess, Colorado had done enabling legislation to allow communities to give property tax credits for donating to programs such as, you know, right now the only one we have in the state is the New Haven Promise, but they are creating programs like that. Those are all long-term pie in the sky, so again, I put that out now so you can tell me how crazy I am without having to go on record to do so. And with that being said, we don't have a date for the next meeting. I will get together with Roberta and with Jeannie, or with Jeannie, and then Jeannie will find out the date, and Jeannie will tell us when we are going to, the two times we are going to meet in January. So, again, thank you all very much for your time, and I wish you a happy, healthy New Year's and a happy holiday. So thank you.